and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
On today's show, we are continuing our month-long series on healthcare by examining the causes for the difference between healthcare costs in the United States and Alaska's healthcare costs, which have been shown to be the highest of any state and arguably the highest in the world. This event was hosted by Alaska Common Ground on December 13th at 49th State Brewing Company. You will hear seven panelists who each begin the program with a four-minute introduction, setting out their views on the causes for Alaska's high healthcare costs. The program starts with Bruce Lamoureux, CEO of Providence Health and Services Alaska.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you. I'm Bruce Lamoureux. I serve as Chief Executive for Providence Health and Services Alaska. I wish to thank Cliff and Alaska Common Ground for the invitation to participate in the dialogue this evening. I welcome the opportunity to contribute to our shared understanding of what's happening in healthcare, which is a complex issue, as everyone knows, or most everyone, right? I represent Providence Alaska Medical Center, as well as the other portfolio services in Alaska, so the critical access hospitals in Kodiak, Seward, and Valdez, long-term care, assisted living, joint ventures, including Flight Ambulance. So a full portfolio of services. I am not representing the hospital industry. While I can speak to some of the issues, that is not my role this evening. And certainly, if you hear nothing else from me, you should hear that hospitals, in fact, as is painfully obvious, are part of the problem as far as high healthcare costs in Alaska. I encourage your attentiveness and clarity as all of us engage in dialogue and begin talking about the charges in healthcare, the pricing of healthcare, reimbursement, and costs. Those are very different issues, and depending on the perspective from which a speaker is offering commentary or posing questions, it may mean something different in each instance. So the higher costs of care in Alaska compared to the Pacific Northwest are driven in part by some of the following. There are the usual suspects: labor, utilities, shipping, facilities, the things that all of you are acquainted with, no matter the industry you serve in. There is also something that is a little more unique in Alaska, and that is the insufficiency of post-acute care patient placement options. And by that I mean, just because someone who is sitting in an acute care inpatient bed is deemed no longer meeting criteria for acute continuation of acute care, does not mean there is a place to send that individual. They may be homeless, there may be a multitude of issues involved. So that's an issue. In other markets, there is more in the way of post-acute care accommodation, and so that diminishes the costs of care when available. Other circumstances and or services that are unique to Providence Alaska Medical Center, the largest acute care facility in Alaska, it is essentially the county hospital, among other things. So if you're in Los Angeles, Seattle, elsewhere, there are county hospitals. We don't have that in Anchorage or Alaska. And so by default, Providence Alaska Medical Center is the county hospital. We have services where there is insufficient demand to justify or attract independent physicians to come into the community and provide service. And so in those instances, Providence, Alaska will employ a number of physicians in order to create both income streams for the individuals and life practice balance that is reasonable for them. We instituted a senior care clinic in response to community needs. We have a trauma center for both adults and pediatrics. Not every hospital has that. Most do not. We are a disproportionate share hospital, which is a designation identifying institutions that take care of a larger than average number of patients with lesser reimbursement. And going back to the issue of insufficiency of post-acute care patient placement, through August of this year, Providence, Alaska Medical Center has had 2,700 days plus of uncompensated care. So patients sitting in beds for which there is zero reimbursement. That drives up the cost for others. So with that, I'm going to give whatever few seconds I may have left to others and then anticipate your questions and commentary later in the program.
Thank you, Mr. Lamoureux.
Thank you. So our next panelist is Dr. Robert R.J. Hall, who's an orthopedic surgeon and leader at Orthopedic Physicians Alaska. Dr. Hall.
So for those of you who don't know me, I'm R.J. Hall. I've been practicing here in Anchorage for orthopedic surgery for the last 22 years. So I've seen a few things. But I don't want to promote myself as a healthcare cost expert, but I actually have reviewed data on healthcare costs over the last few years. I have served for several years on something called the Medical Services Review Committee. We advise the State Workers' Compensation Board on the work comp medical fee schedule. So over the last few years, our committee has reviewed a large amount of data regarding costs in almost all areas of healthcare, whether it's physicians, hospitals, drugs, PT, air ambulances, anything you can bill for, we've looked at it. So some of the things that we've found, probably the main point that I would say is good data on healthcare costs is actually really hard to come by. Because it's so hard to come by for certain areas like private insurance, our committee has actually paid several vendors for data, both for work comp insurance and commercial insurance. Everybody's data is a little bit different. Private insurance data is especially hard to come by. Nobody's required to report any of this data, so most people don't. The data that gets used is usually some small subset, and you don't really know how representative it is. Absent something like an all-payer claims database, we probably won't ever have a totally accurate view. And I think like 14 states or something have that. Second, to state the obvious, costs are higher in Alaska, and pretty much this is across the board, not just physicians and hospitals. In general, what we have seen is that prices for services haven't necessarily gone up all that much. They just haven't gone down like they have everywhere else. I think a lot of that in Alaska has just been more inertia than anything else. For the last 2 years, we've made reductions in the work comp medical fee schedule. These reductions have been in all the areas to various degrees. During public testimony and correspondence that we receive, I would say that pretty much all groups recognize that costs need to come down and are willing to accept that. The vigorous discussion is by how much, and of course everybody's in favor of the other guy cutting his costs. So, what everybody also agrees is that there's a lot of cost shifting going on. Hospitals and providers provide the indigent care, like Bruce said, and the trauma care for free, except it isn't free. The private insurance patient is helping pay for that. Many clinics couldn't afford to see Medicare or Medicaid patients unless they have enough private pay patients. Like Bruce said, a lot of these things are paid for differently in other states through other mechanisms, through state or federal subsidies, i.e. taxes, and not through insurance. In Alaska, private insurance pays a share of pretty much everybody else's health care, and we are not paying state income taxes. I'd make a couple other observations as somebody who's been around practicing for a while. One, there's a lot more spending on healthcare in Alaska these days because there's a lot more healthcare available. There are more specialists in the smaller towns, more subspecialists in the bigger towns, more facilities. When I came up here, you know, people used to travel outside and didn't think about it. You traveled outside for care. But now people can get services here that they didn't used to be able to get. Now more dollars are being spent in Alaska that used to be spent outside. And then also, when I first came to Alaska, I worked at the old AMC down on 3rd, downtown, if any of you have been around long enough to remember that. Orthopedic surgeons at that time, we were the highest paid doctors, and we made $80,000 a year. If you drive down Tudor Road these days, you can't help but notice that things have changed in the native healthcare system. Back then, it was an IHS facility funded almost entirely by federal appropriations to the IHS. But back in the 90s, the native healthcare system started billing Medicare, Medicaid, private insurance. Now 40% of Alaska Medicaid spending goes to native healthcare. With a state Medicaid budget of about $1.8 billion a year, that's an additional $700 million a year just in Medicaid being spent in Alaska that didn't used to be spent here. And that's not a criticism of the native system at all. They're doing a great job, and I don't want to have that misinterpreted. Alaska has some unique challenges in delivering health care, and we do have higher prices in the private insurance segment, but I think overall we're experiencing the same health care cost crisis that everybody else is. You can hear health care horror stories in any state. Health care spending is on an unsustainable trajectory everywhere, not just in Alaska. So we'll see tonight if anybody else has got any great ideas.
Thank you, Dr. Hall. Now we're going to turn to another orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Alan Gross. Dr. Gross, could you describe 4 minutes or less your views on the causes of Alaska's high healthcare costs, also knowing that if you don't get your questions answered tonight, come see these people, buttonhole them, maybe even offer to buy them a beer. You'll get even more out of them. Dr. Gross.
Hi. I'm Al Gross. I'm the orthopedic surgeon that's been in the news a lot, so sorry about that. We're here to discuss why healthcare costs are so much higher in Alaska than in the rest of the United States. Premiums in Alaska are triple the national average, and it's not a lot more expensive to practice medicine in Alaska. In fact, practice and hospital overhead are approximately 30% higher than down south at most. The reason why healthcare costs so much more in Alaska is because prices have escalated to very high levels. So it's prices, not the costs, that we're talking here. When you look at the data, you'll see that it's not because of higher pharmaceutical prices in Alaska, it's not because of higher insurance company margins, and it's not because of higher medical malpractice rates. These are all pretty similar to down south. What stands out is that physicians and hospitals are paid a lot more than for their services down south. It turns out that hospital charges account for approximately 42% of our healthcare dollar, and physician services account for approximately 30% of each healthcare dollar consumed in Alaska. And 80% of healthcare insurance reimbursements to physicians in Alaska are being paid to specialists, 80%. And in Alaska, specialists are reimbursed anywhere from 2 to 5 times more than the national average compared to their colleagues down south. And by specialists, I mean anywhere from radiologists, dermatologists, virtually all types of surgeons, pretty much everyone except for primary care. Primary care physicians in Alaska are reimbursed about 1.5 the national average. So clearly, this is not a primary care problem in Alaska. Hospitals in Alaska, on the other hand, have margins of 3 to 4 times the national average. And considering their market share, this accounts for a great deal of money as well, more than the physicians. I believe historically that there are 3 major reasons as to why specialists in Alaska have been able to charge so much more than our colleagues down south. First, we are very geographically isolated. Second, monopolies have been allowed to form, essentially killing any form of competition. And thirdly, we have in place an insurance regulation, the 80th percentile rule, on which we'll hear more about tonight, which has allowed specialist fees to rise without restraint for a long time. This is capitalism in healthcare, not malicious greed. This has nothing to do with whether a physician is a nice guy or not, or a good physician or not. With respect to hospitals, there is no managed care in Alaska, which has been shown to bring down costs to consumers considerably down south. Legislation in the 1990s has prevented managed care from penetrating into Alaska. There may be other reasons as to why hospital charges are so high, and I'm hopeful that Mr. Lamoureux can honestly address those. This is clearly not just a Juneau problem. This isn't a personal problem. You can attack me as an individual, but really this is a statewide problem. If this was just a Juneau problem, you wouldn't all be sitting here tonight. And the big problem is that the consumer, people that buy health care, are getting a really bad deal in Alaska. Wealth inequality has been a hot topic in America recently, and while I'm a big believer in free market capitalism, health care in Alaska, at least with respect to specialty and hospital care, there is no free market, and with third-party payers increasing their payments to providers and hospitals almost without restraint up until recently, the consumer has had very little to say in the process. And this is what happens when you have monopolies and third-party payers in healthcare. While so many specialists have recently signed on as in-network providers, they have signed on at rates that are still much higher than the national average. Much, much higher. Access and cost of healthcare is the number one issue in our country right now. And in Alaska, the economy can't sustain these high prices anymore. We need to find a better model for healthcare delivery, such as a single-payer system, which would rectify our aberrant billing system and would cover everyone for a lot less money than we're currently spending today. Thank you, Dr. Gross.
This is Addressing Alaskans on FM 91.1. You are hearing a lively panel discussion on the causes of Alaska's high healthcare costs. The panelists are explaining their views on why costs are so high. We return to Alaska Common Ground Chair Cliff Groh, who moderated the event.
And now we're going to turn to Dr. Stanley Watkins, a cardiologist and leader at the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute. Dr. Watkins.
Thanks. Thanks, Cliff. Thank you so much for putting this together and giving us an opportunity to speak for ourselves. I'm an interventional cardiologist. I've worked at the Alaska Heart Institute since 2005. The Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute was founded in 1999 on a premise of access to advanced cardiac care for all Alaskans, regardless of ability to pay. That premise rings true today. We treat all patients that come through our doors regardless of ability to pay. In fact, 60% of our patients that we see at the Heart Institute are government payers. The largest portion of that government payers are Medicare patients. We also see around 10% uninsured and a little bit less than 40% commercial insured patients. We are the largest outpatient non-native Medicare provider in the state. One in three Medicare patients who are Alaskans are seen and followed by the Alaska Heart Institute. We're in-network providers for all major payers. And although our costs are higher than the lower 48 for a myriad of reasons, our costs are lower than our Alaska competition. We compete with the acute care hospitals in South Central Alaska for invasive cardiac procedures. And we've successfully moved a large portion of our inpatient procedures to the outpatient office setting for a total savings to the patients and the healthcare system of 50 to 80%. We compete with 11 imaging centers in South Central Alaska for cardiovascular imaging, and our policy is to have the lowest price for all non-invasive imaging. The biggest problem we see in providing care in Alaska is a physician shortage for cardiovascular services. With Alaska's population of 750,000, by national standards, we should have 70 cardiologists serving our population. We currently have 32 cardiologists. 24 of those 32 cardiologists work at the Alaska Heart Institute. And those 24 docs are responsible for the outpatient management of the entire non-native cardiovascular population in the state. We provide 24/7 hospital call coverage in Anchorage and at Matsu Hospital. We supply backup and subspecialty coverage for all other cardiology practices in the state, and we provide 24/7 phone access for referring physicians and patients. If a patient shows up at 2 o'clock in the morning with a myocardial infarction at any hospital in South Central Alaska, they'll see an Alaska Heart Institute general cardiologist within 20 minutes, and their artery will be opened within 60 minutes. We have been trying to attract To serve the patients of Alaska, we've been trying to attract additional cardiovascular practitioners to our practice for since it was founded in 1999. We've identified a need for at least 5 additional general cardiologists. And despite aggressive recruiting efforts for the past decade, we have been only able to recruit 4 additional cardiologists to our practice. And over that same time period, we've lost 6 to retirement or moving out of state. Over the next decade, we anticipate losing 11 of our existing 24 docs to retirement. And with the Medicare demographic, the fastest growing population in the state, our work is just starting to build. We recognize that we're the stewards of cardiovascular care in the state of Alaska, and we understand the gravity of that responsibility. We also understand the dire fiscal crisis affecting Alaska and the unsustainable rise in healthcare costs. We've initiated cost control measures to improve the efficiency with which we deliver care and disease management programs to improve the quality of care we deliver. We look forward to not only participating, but leading and finding solutions to our complex problem. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Watkins. Now we turn to a man who has written more than a dozen newspaper columns on this topic and hosted at least 2 radio shows on it, Charles Woolforth.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Cliff. I'm the only person on the panel who's not in any way involved with healthcare or healthcare regulation. And in fact, I've never found the topic of healthcare to be particularly intrinsically interesting. The reason I started writing about it was because it's very important, and I think it's having a huge impact on Alaskans and our economy. The way I've tried to approach it is to try to simplify the question, because there are so many complex issues that can be thrown into the mix. And essentially what we do as journalists is follow the money and figure out where's the money coming from, where is it going. And so when you do that, and Dr. Gross has already made some of these comments, you can separate out some things. We know Alaskans don't have overutilization of healthcare. Our utilization is below average. We know that pharmaceuticals aren't so super out of line in Alaska. Most healthcare in Alaska is delivered in Anchorage. The cost of living in Anchorage is lower than it is in Seattle. So why are the costs so much higher here? We also, you know, the question of cost shifting is a big one. But you really don't have to worry about that if you look at it at a macro level. If you look at it as a per capita, how much do we spend as a totality for Alaska for all our healthcare and how many people live here? We still know we're off the charts. I divide causes into sort of 2 categories. One would be structural causes, which are about what our state is like and how many people are here and how small our communities are. And the other would be causes which are more in the control of the political process and the fact that politically we've had no will to deal with this cost crisis. We've done a lot of stuff around insurance, but there's been nothing done about cost from the political level. So in terms of structural things, small communities with 1 or 2 hospitals, with a few practices for each specialty, frankly, we're never going to have, there's no way you'd ever have competition that would be vigorous like in another state, because you need more than 2 players in order to have real competition. So the lack of competition is a problem. And that's been addressed. But then in terms of how does that play out in terms of political process, I think the 80% rule, which requires out-of-network, requires insurance companies to pay out-of-network 80% of the charge, usual customary charge, allows specialty, that is the non-competitive practices, to charge essentially what they want. That's a rule that used to exist many places in the country. Now we're the only state that still has it. And that points to sort of a whole suite of regulations and laws that we have that other places don't have anymore. If you look at, it's not only that we have higher cost, it's that our cost has escalated faster than the rest of the country. And in terms of a goal that we would go for, if we could just have our cost escalate at the same rate as the rest of the country, we'd be better off, right? It'd be great to get down to the rest of the country, maybe that's not realistic. But elsewhere in the country, they no longer have fee-based services. They're doing value-based services. We don't have that in Alaska. In the rest of the country, they have managed care. We don't have that. In the rest of the country, they've gotten rid of the 80% rule. If you go out of network, you're going to get killed, so you don't go out of network. And that gives the insurance company the ability to negotiate a good price with your provider. Other states have gotten rid of the certificate of need law that we have, which allows hospitals to maintain a lack of competition. The U.S. Department of Justice specifically asked Alaska to repeal our certificate of need law last year because, you know, academic study tells you it causes higher prices, but we haven't done that. In fact, we haven't really done the most basic thing, which is we could go to our excellent social and economic research institution at the University of Alaska, and we say, here's $200,000. Tell us why the costs are so high. We haven't done that. We've got a terrific scientist there who wants to do it. Nobody's paid him to do it. I got to say, well, maybe we don't want to know, right? Maybe our power structure would just rather leave the situation the way it is. Hopefully that's changing. But we haven't done the basic things we could do. And then after that, we could maybe start thinking about the big things, like the single payer, these other really difficult things that are much harder that would address some of those structural problems.
Thank you, Charles. Now we're going to go to someone who has observed this question of the state's high healthcare costs from a position as a state regulator. Lori Wing-Hire is the director of the Alaska Division of Insurance. Lori Wing-Hire, why are Alaska's healthcare costs so high?
Well, the cost of healthcare is not a new subject in Alaska. Our costs have been higher for years. As Dr. Hall talked about, I remember discussions on this on workers' compensation when I was a broker, and employers were very worried of how they were going to provide workers' compensation. But we have just started the conversations on healthcare. Recent efforts that the Work Comp Board has made a difference in workers' compensation. But again, the conversations on healthcare specifically have just started. Access to healthcare is essential. There's not a one of us that will go through life without needing it at some point in time. Moreover, we want it to be the best. No one wants to send a family member to a doctor that gets, or a facility that gets, one star on Yelp. And there's a cost to having the best. We want it to be convenient. We don't want to go back to perhaps the way we were in the 1980s or earlier, when the majority of healthcare was performed in Anchorage and people traveled great distances to receive healthcare, making us look more like a third world country than Alaska. The size of our state does present some very unique challenges. We're a large geographic mass with limited facilities. We have a small population, and we're fractured. We're fractured in the fact that we've got Medicaid, Medicare, VA, TRICARE, commercial insurance, and in that, we have self-insured, small group, and large group. We're paying for health care in a variety of ways, and yet we think that if we went to a single payer or some other common mechanism, that the cost would go down, and that's not necessarily true. There will always be a cost to health care. How we fund it is the conversation. We should expect to make some changes in how we access care, looking much like ANTHC has done and looking at the whole person in a holistic manner, reviewing value-based payments, education on the role of primary care and on the role of emergency care, telemedicine. These discussions are starting to happen and we're starting to see some results, but it's going to be a slow process. We expect it to be affordable, but yet how many of us grew up in a home or in our own home thought once the deductible was paid, particularly on employer-based plans, the health care was free? We weren't using our health care smart. This is going to take time. This is a system that has been around since World War II. So we need to come up with solutions that are not biting out small chunks at once, but look at what we're going to be at the end of this process. Because if we do little small bites at a time, we could be worse off than when we are. It's probably a bad analogy, but when Costco came to Alaska, it changed the way we buy groceries and it changed the way we buy household goods, but it didn't necessarily drop the prices at Fred Meyer's. It just made us think about it. And it made us think about the way we purchase and how we're spending our money. So tonight's conversation is not just the cost of healthcare, but it's what do we want and what do we need? Do we want it to be convenient? meaning do we want the facilities here in Anchorage? Do we want facilities in Seward? Do we want facilities in Fairbanks, in Ketchikan, in Nome? Because there's a cost to having those facilities with a very small population and recruiting people to staff those facilities.
Thank you, Lori Wing-Hire. Now we turn as our final panelist's opening statement to Jennifer Myoff, who's the legislative co-chair of the Alaska Association of Health Underwriters. Jennifer Myoff, why does Alaska have such high health care costs?
Well, the advantage of being at the end of the row here is that a lot of the conversation has been addressed, but I'm going to focus from a different perspective a little bit, which is, for one, I'm a lifetime Alaskan. That's not unique here, but I'm proud of it. And I've been in the employee benefits consulting business for over 25 years. So I help employers figure out what kind of employee benefits they can offer to their employees and what they can afford to offer, what they want to offer, and what that looks like as they make those choices. And if you'll indulge me, I'm going to try to read mostly so that I don't miss anything. I promise I won't read if you ask me questions, though. So I, over my years as a consultant, I've educated employers and all kinds of ranges of employee benefits services, short-term counseling for employee mental health needs, medical plans, dental, vision, life, disability, all kinds of benefits that an employer might want to offer to their employees. Really, over that time, I have seen so many changes in Alaska. But part of what I've also witnessed by virtue of being involved in some larger national organizations is changes that have happened in the lower 48 that haven't happened here. Really what I saw and what I remember is really in the 90s, early 2000s, prices were kind of spiking everywhere to buy medical insurance in particular, or medical care. And what happened by about the mid-2000s is prices or trend increases started lowering a bit. And what it turned out to be, much of what was driving that nationally, was the directed care, so HMOs, managed care, those kind of things that were mentioned, but are not allowed in Alaska. So really by the mid-2000s, Lower 48 was starting to trend down. Alaska was not trending down at all. We were continuing to trend up. And really, I work with employers large and small. So, I mean, I've seen this across the spectrum of employers trying to offer services. We've seen very little coordination of care ever. I mean, we're Alaskans. We grew up being told we can go to whoever we want to go to. Don't tell me I have to go to a primary care physician before I go see your nose and throat guy. If I want to go see him, I'm going to call up and I'm going to go see him, even though maybe I could receive just as good a care from a non-specialist that provides great service at a lesser cost. So that's been a fundamental core of who we are as Alaskans, and we like it that way. But that can make an impact in terms of the lack of coordination of appropriate levels of care. Many of my employer clients are self-funded, so I have clients that purchase medical care on the market through carriers, fully insured plans, but I have many employers that are self-funded. So I actually see what kind of claims are coming through, and that's where we really start to see some real differences. One piece would be medevacs, and many of you in the room may have experienced or heard stories. If you're in the North Slope, if you're in Barrow or Dutch Harbor, and you need to be transported to Anchorage, or let's say Anchorage to Seattle, it easily could be $125,000 for a one-way flight for one patient. Amazing, amazing. Lack of transparency has been a real challenge. And this year, many of you are probably aware, the municipality of Anchorage passed the ordinance that will require some transparency within Anchorage. So that's one piece of the puzzle, and we'll see if that makes any difference. It affects just Anchorage. Another unique item in Alaska, and it's been mentioned a couple of times, is the 80th percentile regulation. So really, that was originally provided to or put in place as a protection for patients. so that they wouldn't be billed from the providers amounts that weren't covered by a plan. Really, the unintended what it did is it mandated then carriers to pay for out-of-network providers at the eighth highest bill out of 10 bills for the same procedure. So in other words, you had 10 bills come in, that carrier has to pay at the eighth highest amount. And that amount is updated twice a year, which means the rates continue to go up without any cap, but it has a floor. So it brings the water line of all those charges up, particularly for out of network providers. The unintended consequences is because there's no cap, then the prices still go up, and then patients can still be balance billed for the amounts that weren't paid to that provider. The overall costs, I know my time is getting up. The last couple of things I want to just mention briefly is Milliman, many of you may have heard Milliman, the independent actuarial and consulting firm, did a study. The Alaska asked for the study in 2011, and then they updated it in 2016, comparing commercial health care claims and payments in Alaska versus other states in comparable areas in 2011, but then all across the nation and in specific areas more broadly in 2016. The key findings of the most recent Milliman report was that provider payment levels in Alaska are 76% higher than levels nationwide. Physician levels are 148% higher. Hospital payments are 56% higher. Also, comparing the 26 report to the 2011 report as sort of the baseline, payment levels in Alaska grew faster in Alaska than the comparison state levels over that five-year period. So Alaska payments grew overall at an additional 10% higher than whatever those rates had already grown, 15% excess growth for physicians, 6% excess growth for hospitals. So really, in conclusion, from my perspective, talking to our employees, our clients, our employers, many of them don't even realize kind of what the issue is. I go into a meeting and I say, who's your healthcare provider? And they'll say, oh, it's Blue Cross or Aetna. I say, no, they're not your provider. They don't provide any healthcare. Physicians and hospitals and pharmacists provide your care or your treatment, but those companies really just help pay for it. So it's sort of like somebody asking, what car do you drive? And somebody says, Geico. Well, there's a real disconnect. So we consistently fail to focus on the real problem. We intermingle health care with health insurance. Those are two very distinctly different things. And while we absolutely have expensive insurance in our country, it's a result of the problem of high health care charges, not the cause.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you are listening to Addressing Alaskans. We've been featuring experts and physicians examining the causes for Alaska's high healthcare costs. This is part of a series of events on healthcare costs hosted by Alaska Common Ground. We're going back to the stage to Alaska Common Ground Chair Cliff Groh, who moderated the event.
So now we're going to go to a different round, which where each of the panelists on this stage gets a chance to ask another panelist a question. Now, the rules are that the question can be no longer than a minute, and the answer can be no longer than 2 minutes. So we're going to start with you, Bruce Lamoureux. Please pick a panelist on this stage and ask them a question.
All right. Awesome. My question is for Lori. Lori, Mark Foster did a study for the state vis-a-vis the healthcare authority. And in that, if I understood the review correctly, Mark identified or cited a reference indicating that in order to have an adequately sized pool of subscribers, one would need about 100,000 people to spread risk. Is that congruent with your view as far as managing risk across a population? And do you think that is achievable in Alaska, where in Mark's review, the healthcare authority has the potential of capturing a universe of approximately 114,000 people?
There's no doubt that The premise of insurance is to spread the risk across a great number. The larger the pool you have, the more that pool can absorb and keep the individual contributions smaller. When you look at Alaska, and we have a little over 700,000 people, and you deduct from that those that are not what I would call in the commercial insurance market. So you're going to take out Medicaid, Medicare, TRICARE, VA, and then you're going to take out the self-insured plans, because those employers, as Jennifer talked about, are paying the cost directly. So the insured population in Alaska is probably somewhere around 15% of the total population. And when you, that makes it very hard for the insured population to support itself with the cost of health care. And quite frankly, we have an aging population that goes back and adds to that cost as you look at it overall. So the health care authority looked at, if you took the state of Alaska and as a starting block, and then took certain segments of the population, and we have trust with, you know, union trust, and so there's complications there. But then what we call the political subdivisions, the school districts, the municipalities and such, and if they were bundled together, would there be a cost benefit to putting every of all of those together to make it a larger pool, be it 100,000 or 120,000? And then if that were sustainable, would we look at possibly bringing in the individual market, not-for-profits, and other small groups to, again, have more of a larger pool, much like how many are insured with State Farm? Probably more than are insured with Aetna on healthcare when you look at it as an individual. And so we need those kind of numbers to make it affordable statewide.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Ms. Wenghire. Dr. Hall, could you pick a panelist on this panel and ask them a question no more than a minute?
Okay. Well, it's probably isn't what you were expecting, but this is for Lori Wenghire or Jennifer Myhoff. So private insurers always compare physician reimbursement to Medicare rates, and they have their goal is to get physicians to accept Medicare rates for private insurance. They don't apply those considerations to themselves, though. Seema Verma, the head of the Center of Medicare and Medicaid Services in Washington, D.C., oversees an organization that provides health care for 120 million people with a budget of about $900 billion. She makes about $225,000 a year. Medicare overhead is estimated to be about 5 to 6%. Jeff Rowe, the CEO of Premera Blue Cross, provides insurance for about 2 million people and has revenues of about $2 billion. He makes about $4 million a year, or about 15 times Medicare rates. Private insurance takes about 18 to 20 cents of the private health care dollar for their costs and profits. They operate at about four times Medicare rates. While physician reimbursements for private insurance only ever go down, insurance executive pay only ever goes up. Is there anything that companies buying insurance or in the marketplace or the state of Alaska could do to entice private insurance companies to help lower their operating costs and do their part to help hold down costs?
I'll tackle it first. Any insurance company in the state of Alaska, and it doesn't necessarily just mean health insurance, it's property and casualty, so it's your homeowners or your auto, or and it's commercial, they have to do a filing with the state of Alaska. And by statute, the rates cannot be excessive, nor can they be inadequate. And the inadequacy comes because we don't want insolvent insurance companies. We don't want to see a case where an insurance company has taken your funds, you've paid your premium, but at some point they're unable to pay your bills. In this filing, my point is that they will have what we call a contingency. And the contingency is basically going to be their profit. So we know going in what they're expecting based on the pool, what they're expecting to earn. Sometimes they're dead on, sometimes they're a little off. But generally the contingencies, and this would include all salaries, all operations, are less than 5% for any line of insurance. So while we can't tell them what to pay any one individual, nor can I control it to say that a share should only be worth so much, what we do look at when we're allowing those rates to be set is what the contingencies are, or what we're allowing them to have for profit. In the past few years, we've had very few that are over 3%.
I can add to it, being from the self-funded employer perspective. So because we have clients that are self-funded, we are really intimately involved in all the components that make up their plan. So when I say self-funded, the vast majority of employers in Alaska are a size at which they still have some protection. We buy excess loss coverage should their claims exceed large amounts. But what I can tell you is, and I think I failed to mention, I was going to, that of the, let's say, 100% of the medical costs for their program, 80 to 85% consistently are claims themselves, the cost of the health care. So the MRIs, the doctor visits, the surgeries, the hospital visits. 15% is them buying the administration components to process those claims, right? Employers don't know how to process claims and adjudicate properly and make sure an employee paid their deductible or out-of-pocket max and how much was that and how much more do they owe. That's, we hire a third-party administrator to do that. So they have a job, and that's adjudicating claims. We hire a care management company to help take care of sick people so that they can get the proper care and have somebody help them manage through the process. We hire, maybe purchase a part of a network so that we can maybe get some discounts through preferred providers, ideally, and sort of back to kind of the bulk purchasing. One of the advantages, from my perspective, of self-funding is it's nice because you really can look at all the different components and dig in and see what's reasonable based on the market.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on Alaska Public Media. This show is continuing our series examining Alaska's high healthcare costs with a panel of experts and physicians. We return to moderator Cliff Groh, who is chair of Alaska Common Ground.
Dr. Gross, please pick a panelist and ask a question.
My question's for Jennifer, but please feel free to chime in, Lori. I read the testimony in January of 2017 of whether to repeal the 80th percentile rule, and you were one of the people that presented, and I read your testimony. You argued against the 80th percentile rule, as did most other people that presented. In fact, the only people that argued to retain it were physician groups. Why do you think the state continues to hold on to this? Is it to stabilize the insurance market so that we don't have chaos with balanced billing and access? What's the motivation, do you think, that it is really at heart here?
Well, I'll very briefly answer it. I'll let Lori jump in because, I mean, we've had lots of conversations about this.
Let me just finish. A couple of other really great things that you've done, Lori, you know, there's the state reinsurance program and the 1035 waiver sort of fall into the same category of stabilizing, keeping us from chaos. And so do you think we'll have chaos if we repeal the 80th percentile rule and put a lot of, to me, it seems as though it would put a lot of pressure on physicians to drop their fees.
So I'll give you my brief perspective. I don't think we'll have chaos. I think it will be painful for a short while. And because, again, back to my comments about the 80th percentile was originally built as a consumer protection. My opinion is that that is no longer protecting consumers. And instead, it's inflating costs because it's inflating the ability for providers to charge what they want if they're not in a network. I know that Lori has come from the perspective as consumer protection because that's certainly a component of her job. I believe there are other ways to protect consumers that we can put into place in lieu of the 80th percentile.
Okay. Do you want to comment too?
Well, I might as well take it because I think it's coming. Jennifer made a statement earlier that the 80th percentile, it's not the 80th percent that insurers have to pay at, it's the 80th percentile. So you look at the top, you look at 10 and you're looking at the top 8 that the insurance companies are required to pay above that level, and that's the ceiling, or the maximum, or the minimum, I should say. So this is where we're at on the 80th percentile. I talked a little bit about how many people are actually subject to this. And we're thinking somewhere north of 10, less than 15% of the insured population, because that's all the 80th percentile pertains to by regulation. However, other plans can adopt it, but they're not required to, self-insured plans in large group. So when you look at how many are insured that way, they are not subject by regulation to put the 80th percentile in their plans. So what is the 80th percentile? You go to the doctor and you get a $1,000 bill and you come home and you find out that they've paid $250 because the insurance company has decided that that's how much they're going to pay for that service. We have said by regulation that no, if someone is paying, and let's face it, insurance premiums are a lot in Alaska right now, they always have been, but they should have a minimum benefit that they should expect for any charge to be paid back at. And the 80th percentile is what was adopted in 2004. Repealing it does not require that physicians lower their rates. It simply dictates what an insurance company is going to pay of your bill. So it can be repealed. But what's going to happen to consumers is you're going to see larger balance billings. And right now, that is not addressed in Alaska, of how much one should walk away with of a balanced bill when they have received care. And that is our largest concern with repealing it, is what is going to happen to consumers, because insurance companies will be left at their own discretion of how much they are going to pay for any one service or fee.
Thank you. Charles Wolforth, do you have a question for one of the people on the panel?
I want to continue on the question of physician salaries. And I don't think that physician salaries are the main problem, because most of the money, a larger portion of the money is going to facilities. But it's a problem that we can all understand about, like, how much money does it take for somebody to do a particular job? And, you know, we know something publicly about physician salaries. There's a surgeon at the Central Peninsula Hospital who was being paid $1.5 million by that nonprofit government hospital. There's a physician at the Homer Hospital who was being paid over $1 million. And I found court records of physicians here in Anchorage being paid in the multiple millions. And then Dr. Gross said that he had been compensated at a level of $2.5 million at his practice, which is many multiples of what similar doctors are making outside. So I guess my question to Dr. Gross is, do you think that that's true, that Alaska specialist physicians are being paid much more than they are outside, and in other words, with your colleagues that you know in the lower 48? And if that's the case, then why aren't physicians rushing here for jobs? Because it would seem like most of us, we'd like to make a lot of money. Why do we have a physician shortage in some specialties?
I don't think physicians are going to rush to Alaska for jobs because of the money. It's not what brought me to Alaska. I was born and raised here. A number of people who grew up in Alaska who became physicians came back to Alaska. And I've told a number of my colleagues down south of the fiscal potential up here in Alaska, and the universal response is, why would I want to live there? My family's here. This is what I know. I don't want to move to Alaska. And so I don't think it's the money that brings people to Alaska. And it's certainly true that physicians are being paid specialists in many cases are being paid 3 to 5 times what our colleagues are being paid down south. I have a number of friends in a number of states, at least in orthopedics, and I only talk about orthopedics because that's what I know, but it's true in many other specialties, who are being paid a fifth of what you can make in Alaska, and working even harder than you may work in Alaska. So I don't think it's a compensation model that's going to bring physicians to Alaska, and I don't think that it justifies the high prices that we see here.
Thanks. Dr. Watkins, do you have a question about Alaska's high healthcare costs for another panelist?
Sure, I have a question for Dr. Hall. So in the media, in the newspaper, this conversation on healthcare costs has largely been framed around physician fees and physician prices. how do you feel this has been mischaracterized from your perspective?
I only get 4 minutes or 2 minutes.
2 minutes, yeah.
Well, there's a lot of, I think somebody else mentioned, you know, prices, charges, and reimbursement all mean different things. You know, like in our practice, you know, 50% of the people we see are government payers, but we're required by law to bill everybody the same amount. So even though we know we're going to get paid here, we're required by law to charge them here. So people see this charge, and that has no relationship to what actually happens. So there's, I think, some issues there as a sort of education, is that it is a complicated system, despite what the president believes. And other mischaracterization is that, you know, the private physicians are just seeing private pay patients, and actually that's not the case. I mean, I'm sure in your practice too. I mean, the major, I think 35% of the people we see have private pay. Everybody else is from some other source, either workers' comp, Medicare, Medicaid, VA. And so it's, and we get a different price from everybody, or different reimbursement from everybody. And so when people talk about transparency, they say, well, what do you charge for, or what's your fee for that? Well, what do you mean? I mean, who are you? And that's the issue, or not the issue, but that's the reality of it. And so it is hard to, so I would say that that's part of the, that complexity with billing and all these different levels is part of the problem.
Okay, thank you. Lori Winghire, do you have a question for someone on the panel about Alaska's high healthcare costs?
I would ask this of Bruce. If you were going to change something and you looked at what Medicaid, Medicare, and the workers' compensation, and they're all based on different systems. You're reimbursed, as the doctors are, all on different systems, as we were just talking about with Dr. Hall. In doing that, we know that there's cost shifting. And how do we stop the cost shifting to the private market or into employers? If you have any comments of how we would.
Good
because
luck
it's,
to
it's
me,
basically
right?
Making it, balancing it out.
That's a solution. Careful.
The fundamental problem is the system is so fragmented, so broken, so rife with perverse incentive for various behaviors that every time we add one more rule, one more stipulation on charges, reimbursement, et cetera, we only confound the problem. And I think truly, if this was an environment where we were going to design healthcare, including the reimbursement system anew, we would never, never create it in its current image. And what we would likely do is come up with either a single payer system or get off the train and just re-engineer the reimbursement system and take out some of the perverse incentives I'm referring to. So we've heard so far this evening, we've heard charge as a word, we've heard price as a word, we've heard reimbursement as a word. And they all mean different things. So Providence Alaska Medical Center, as an example, has about 30% of its charges, the amount you see on your bill, associated with Medicaid, another 30% with Medicare, and another 30% or so, 32%, commercial insurance. So from Medicare, for $1 of charge, Providence Alaska Medical Center gets 18 cents of reimbursement. From Medicaid, it gets 20 cents for that dollar of charge. And from commercial insurers, it gets approximately 51 cents for that dollar of charges. So to your point and other members or panelists' comments, there are dynamics that are causing cost shifting, and to just add another rule is a fool's errand. It isn't going to work.
Thank you. Chair Vermayoff, do you have a question about the causes of Alaska's high health care costs for one of the other panelists?
Sure. I think I'll piggyback with Lori, so Mr. Lamro.
Okay.
Part of the information that I've seen in the Milliman report is that the margins for hospitals in Alaska are approximately 20% versus margins for hospitals in the lower 48, I think we're 6%.
Seven.
Okay, thank you. Can you share that with us about why that difference, based on what you've just described as kind of the different payer mixes?
Yeah. The elephant in the room is pricing power. That's a key issue. But it's not the only thing. We're having a conversation where we really aren't speaking with clarity to one another. This is about the tyranny of average as a statistic. And we know if there's an average, there are some above the average and there are others below the average. So a year ago, Charles, you and I conversed. At that time, we talked about the 2015 Medicare cost report for Prov-Alaska Medical Center. The margin at that time in that calendar year for Providence was 17%. And I suggested in our conversation that based on what was unfolding in 2016, I would expect a reduction. So number one, the 21% associated with hospitals generally in Alaska is the average in 2014, but it is the tyranny of average, and you can't stamp everyone with 21%. So 2015, Providence, 17%, 2016, Providence, 13%, and 2017, Providence, my hunch, is we're gonna be in single digits this year. So as long as we're talking about averages, and periods that are 3 and 4 and 6 years back, we aren't having the real conversation. And until, I think Lori alluded to this, until we look at individual communities and understand that it is mathematically impossible in Seward, Valdez, and countless other communities to be as efficient as Providence Anchorage can be because of scale, we're trying to solve for something and we're going to continue to be frustrated. So I urge you to be good students of what the margins really are, because averages will simply mislead you.
Thanks. Now we're going to go to, before we go to the audience portion of this, I want to ask a couple questions based on what I've heard so far and the more than 40 interviews I've done to help the Planning Committee design and organize this series. And I keep thinking about conversations I've had with a couple of economists here in Alaska, and I'd like any of you to react to this who want to it. And one of them said, "Hey, Cliff, the way to understand the Alaska healthcare system is it's essentially a tax. Alaska has the lowest taxes in the country, it's well known, but we have a healthcare tax. And it is paid out in higher compensation for providers and more expensive facilities." And he said, "Cliff, you should really think of it as the Alaska stealth health tax, what we have today." And I talked to another economist, I said, I repeated to him a story of a friend of mine who said, "Hey, Cliff, you can, in every society, you can see across time, you can see what a society values most by looking at the most impressive buildings." And so he and I traded examples. In the Middle Ages, you had very important Roman Catholicism in Europe, and it resulted in impressive cathedrals all across Europe. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, there was sort of a wave of civic secular religion in the United States. It resulted in tremendous ornate city halls, courthouses, and even post offices around our country. And so my friend said, "Hey, Cliff, the most impressive building I've been in a long time is Tower T at Providence. That's what's, you know, the most important, sort of like said, sort of the cathedral of our society." So I ran that by another economist, and I said, what's the deal? He said, Cliff, the way to think about Tower T and the OPA building on Lake Otis is they're like our NFL franchise. They're our NFL stadium, only in Alaska not being a major league city. But the difference is people didn't get to vote on higher taxes to pay for the expensive infrastructure that we can't afford. So I'd like anybody on the panel to talk about those frames or perspectives and see if they make sense. Dr. Gross, you want to start, then yeah, Dr. Hall?
I've just got a quick comment. I think going to a football game is a whole lot different than going to the hospital. Football games are elective, and in most cases, going to the hospital, at least for most people, is of necessity. And so I think it's okay in the private world that entrepreneurs make a lot of money off of a good idea, but when we see amazing facilities in the healthcare arena because of all these high prices, I don't think that's right, Cliff. And so that's where I'm at on that.
Okay, Dr. Hall, it looks like you have a thought on this too.
Yeah. So it's probably on both sides, but so on the tax issue, like we mentioned, you know, there's a lot of cost shifting that goes on up here. So everybody likes to compare us to Seattle. So if you're down in Seattle, there's Harborview Medical Center, which is a state-subsidized hospital, built budget of about $1 billion, $500 million of which comes from state and federal subsidies. And so they take care of all the indigent patients, they do the trauma care, and that is paid for mainly by taxpayers. So they're paying a tax to cover that. Up here, Bruce is the trauma center. Bruce takes care of the indigent patients, and the providers do as well. And so instead of that being, I mean, they're just coming out of different buckets. So part of it comes out of the, down there comes out of private insurance, part of it comes out of tax. Up here, the majority of it is, you know, covered by private insurance. I'll say that, but that's the system we have. Unless somebody else is willing to stand up and pony the money for those services, then those would go away. So, and then on the building thing, I got to say, I think that's kind of silly. So if somebody wants to take their money that they could have taken home and spent on their family and they put it in their business to provide a better experience for their patients, and you present that as a bad thing, I don't agree with that at all.
Charles, looks like you have a thought too.
I mean, I think the tax metaphor is not such a good one, because when we have taxes, then we have some We know where the money's going. We may not like it, but we get to vote for people and they pass a budget. And so you can have some measure of what you're paying and what you're getting back. It's really difficult to know what we're paying for in healthcare in Alaska and what we're getting for our dollar. We can look at the totality of all the money spent in Alaska on healthcare and then divide it by the number of people. And that means we don't have to talk about cost shifting, right? Because then we know, okay, as a society, how much are we paying for healthcare? We know it's significantly more than other places that are somewhat like us. So we know, okay, we're paying more for the same thing. And then on the quality side, we can say, well, maybe that's okay if we decided as a society we wanted to have really the best healthcare anywhere. But actually, we know that's not true. Our quality measures are average. They're not that great. And our health outcomes are not that great. So then you have to sort of say, like, where's the money coming from? We're putting all this money in one end of the system, and the outcome at the other end is not superior. And I think that's sort of the essential question, and there's a lot of ways to sort of cut that up. And I think probably Mr. Lamoureux and I are pretty close in terms of thinking, you know, cut the Gordian knot and find a way to manage this system so that it actually makes some sense. But we can also sort of think about it, we can simplify it in the way we think about it and the inputs and the outputs and say, like, okay, it just holistically doesn't make sense. It's not just that they have indigent patients who are going to private healthcare facilities, it's that our entire society, our state, is paying way more and we're not getting better results.
Thank you. A number of the more than 40 people I talked to wanted to point out to me that often there's a focus on prices, but that when you talk about the total bill for healthcare in Alaska, it's prices times utilization. It's you know, what the price it's paid for what procedures, treatments, or surgeries, or whatever are provided. And a number of the people I've talked to, including a number of the physicians and surgeons, would point to certain areas in which they thought that Alaska's unusual reimbursement system set up particularly perverse incentives for wasteful overutilization. And some of the examples I would sometimes get the most were spinal fusions. One neurosurgeon told me, pretty soon, Cliff, everyone in Anchorage will get a spinal fusion because they're so profitable to do. And someone else, and others have also pointed out to pain clinics offering too many injections because they're so profitable. I'd like anyone on the panel to comment on either those examples or other examples of particular procedures, treatments, or surgeries that they think are wastefully overutilized in Alaska because of particularly high reimbursements here in our state.
I know from
Dr. Watkins, looks like you got one.
I'll just speak from the cardiovascular perspective, and so we have national databases and hospital Providence system-wide databases for utilization of cardiovascular procedures, and we are one of the lowest as far as cardiovascular utilization in the Providence system and in the country. And so from a cardiac standpoint, we do not overutilize cardiac care. I can't speak to other areas because I'm not familiar with it.
Thanks. Jennifer Mayhoff, looks like you have a thought, and then I think Dr. Hall does.
Yeah, I would say I don't know that Alaska necessarily has a unique manner in paying for service. I think that's the fee for service model. I think nationally is being challenged as not the best way to pay for care because it incentivizes services. What I think, you know, there was a discussion about overutilization maybe not happening in Alaska, but what I do see happening pretty regularly is there are MRI machines popping up all over town. There are specialized, you know, PET scan machines popping up in, you know, sort of every group practice, it feels like, and I might be over-exaggerating, but I do know I have seen and heard of specifics. So I think that's a built-in incentive for that practice or provider to utilize this machine that is incredibly expensive, incredibly specialized, and fantastic to have for that patient that needs it, but do we have enough patients that need it that make them not want to overutilize it by asking for more and more tests? So I think that's the classic fee-for-service problem that's not unique to Alaska, but certainly affects us.
Thanks. I think, Dr. Hall, you had a thought as well?
Yeah, a couple of thoughts. One on, I only know about my own practice, but sort of nationwide for orthopedic practices, there's something called best practices, surgical conversion rate, the percentage of your new patients that wind up having surgery, and they usually say it shouldn't be, you know, more than 50%. I'll say that at our practice, it's 38%. So there's always going to be outliers, but I think the majority of practitioners in Alaska that I know are not gaming the system. I mean, there are some people that are because there are these perverse incentives, but I don't think you can say that about everybody. One thing about utilization is the comparison is always made, well, we're utilizing at the same rate as the lower 48, but utilization is rising for everybody, so all the boats are rising, so it looks like we're all the same. I can say that in my specialty of orthopedics, you know, the rate of people having hip and knee replacements has doubled in the last 10 years. The rate of people having the shoulder replacements has gone up eightfold in the last 10 years. You know, there's operations like hip arthroscopy and disc replacements that didn't even exist, you know, 10 years ago. And so those kind of things are happening, and they cost money. So, and people are used to being able to get whatever they want, and they come into the office and they say, well, you know, I've been waiting for this. You know, I want the CPM machine. I want the Iceman. I want this. I want that. You know, and so utilization, I think we may be equal, but it's going up everywhere.
Charles, you have a thought, and then Dr. Gross.
And this is sort of on the broad issue of utilization in general. One of the things that I think we have to get used to that has not happened as much here as in the rest of the country is that, while health out, you know, you can save money and be more efficient in a health system and have the same outcome, but people might not like it as much. So in other words, if you have managed care, you might not be able to choose your doctor, but in the end, you might save enough money as an individual, as a society, or as a company, that it would be worth it. And so we've seen some of those changes happen in primary care in Alaska. It's really hard for primary care doctors with what they're able to make these days to be the old-fashioned family doctor who sat there and talked to you for an hour.
or to be the one-person practitioner, or to do those things that are great, but they're not that efficient economically. And guess what? They found out the rest of the country, doctors have much shorter visits, they have much more efficient practices, and prices have stayed down comparatively. Here in Alaska, we have competition among primary care doctors because there's enough of them that the insurance companies have some market power. They can force down their reimbursements. That hasn't happened with the specialist doctors or with the facilities. And so I think you can compare what's happened there with the way the practice happens and the efficiency of what's done.
Dr. Gross, then we're going to go to the audience questions. Yeah.
Now look, economics are a big driver of healthcare utilization. And the problem is, in healthcare, so many things fall in the gray zone. And I think maybe in cardiology that's not true, but certainly for spine fusions, spine injections, and many other orthopedic procedures, a lot of patients fall in the gray zone. What do you do? And in a fee-for-service model, there's the economic incentive to do more. Order MRIs. If somebody's maybe really on the fence, you're always going to be leaning more towards the surgery side. Not always, but there's that economic pressure. And I think it's inherent to our system with the fee-for-service model that encourages that utilization. So you're right, you're going to see more MRIs, more PET scans, more tests that people can do because they're very profitable to own.
I want to go now to a series of questions about getting recruiting or dealing with sort of the supply of providers in Alaska. I think it's important to preface this with a little bit of understanding that there's incredible variation among providers in Alaska in terms of there's a number of primary care physicians in Anchorage that have either left the practice recently of medicine or have gone in into larger practices, closer solo businesses. On the other hand, I thought of you, Dr. Watkins, when I was sitting having coffee recently with an Anchorage neurosurgeon, and you told me recently about your difficulties of recruiting here. And so he told me, well, I had already had his filings from a court case, that he made $1.5 million in another state in 2007, and then he moved to Alaska and made $5.5 million in 2009. And I said, it wasn't difficult to recruit you to come to Alaska, was it? He said, no, he essentially recruited himself, as he acknowledged. So that was a different field. That was in neurosurgery. But there's incredible variation. And he pointed out that when he moved here about 10 years ago, there were 4 neurosurgeons in Alaska. Now there are 11. So there doesn't seem to be sort of a shortage and certainly a rapid growth. So a series of questions about this. One is, can we effectively increase the supply of medical doctors with in-state education availability? The questioner points out this is obviously a long-term plan. Another person, a related question to ask similarly is, has there been a thought or an effort to expand residency or fellowship programs in Alaska in an attempt to attract or retain more specialists, especially with request to cardiology? And Dr. Watkins, you probably have a thought about that.
Absolutely. We've been in discussions with the University of Washington for ever since I've been up here about having away rotations for cardiology fellows to come visit, to see our practice and see Alaska and how great it is to live up here. And we know that if we could get them to come up for 1 month of their fellowship, that a certain number of those fellows would join our practice and move to Alaska. University of Washington doesn't want to share their fellows. They work the heck out of them and they pay them nothing and they do all the clinical work for the University of Washington and they don't want to send them up here to work for us for a month. So we are starting an internal medicine. There's a groundswell to start an internal medicine training program through University of Washington with partly with Providence. Which should help recruit internists, some of which will go on to cardiology training and join our practice. And that's we have a couple of internists that have gone through the University of Washington program that have ended up in our practice as cardiologists. The state really, if you want more good doctors in the state has to invest in medical training, and we only train 20 physicians. A year for the WAMI program to go through medical school. and that's not enough to support the state. That needs to be doubled or tripled if we want to see Alaskans get trained and then come back. We can't, like one of my partner always says, they go to these medical schools in warm states and then they graduate and somehow we're going to expect to attract them to a cold state to practice, and it's just it's tough to do.
Dr. Gross, and get closer to the microphone as that person
says. I'm sorry. Stan's partner, Steve Compton, and I were classmates in the WAMI program. We're both from Alaska, and Steve and I spent a year up in Fairbanks back when the WAMI program was up there. I guess it's down in Anchorage now. But when Steve and I went through, the state had economic incentives to come back. And if you came back to Alaska, I believe half of your student loans through the state were forgiven. They were that forgiveness was then taxed, of course. But there was an economic incentive to come back to Alaska. And that program has gone away. And I think programs like that should be reinstated.
Dr. Hall seems to have a thought.
I would just sort of echo what others have said about recruiting physicians to Alaska. I think, you know, most studies on this show that most residents practice within like 200 miles where they did the residency. So without residencies other than family medicine up here, it is a little more difficult. I can say that in our practice, the majority of the people in our practice either came up here in the public health service like myself or in the military, or they were born here. Convincing people from outside to come up here on, you know, December 13th when it's cold and dark is, you know, everybody loves Alaska on TV, but they don't want to live here.
Thank you. How do nurse salaries in Alaska compare to the lower 48? And then the, sort of the question I think is getting at, are the salaries or compensation of nurses a significant factor in Alaska's higher health care costs? Mr. Watkins, Dr. Watkins, Dr. Gross,
sure.
Charles are sort of looking like you're
interested. Nurses?
Nurses.
I know we, I only know what we pay our nurses at the Heart Institute, and we have to pay a significant premium for nurses. I don't know whether it's 30% more or whatever than it is in the lower 48. Not just nurses, but all the specialty technicians that are involved in our practice, the EKG technicians, the echo technicians, the imaging technicians, all have a, you know, 30 to sometimes 70% increase in salary to bring them to Alaska. There are no training programs for echo technicians, MRI technicians in Alaska. So you have to train somebody or bring somebody up that's already trained in the lower 48. And the only way to do it, you know, unless they're married to somebody that's moved up here for another reason, you have to incentivize them to come.
Dr. Gross, you
have a... Yeah. We had some nurses in our practice, and we had an MRI tech in our practice. And certainly, recruiting and retaining an MRI tech is a lot more difficult than it is for a nurse, which may cost 30% more than down south. Now, Bruce probably has much higher costs dealing with travelers. That's a big problem for hospitals. But in the private setting, you know, the ability to have an MRI tech, and maybe you have to spend twice as much to get one, but you have an MRI in your office, and you're getting paid five times more for an MRI than you'd be getting paid down south. So yes, it's more expensive, but the rewards by having that technology are also very high.
Okay. Is it still true that most primary care physicians do not participate in Medicare? First of all, I'm not asserting this is the questioner, so I'll read it again. This is the question from a quiet audience member. Is it still true that most primary care physicians do not participate in Medicare or won't take new patients on Medicare, so people become de facto uninsured when they go on Medicare?
For access to care, access to primary care for Medicare recipients in Alaska is extremely difficult. So it's every practice is different for primary care, so you can't paint them all with one brush. But I know, you know, the vast majority of my patients are Medicare patients, and for many of them, I am their de facto primary care doctor because they can't get primary care. Now, Providence started a Medicare clinic. There's, you know, a pretty long waiting list to get in there. Dr. George Reinier Sr. started a Medicare clinic in South Anchorage that after 1 year operated at a $1 million loss that was subsidized by the state, later bought by Alaska Regional. but providing, it just speaks to the cost of delivering care in Alaska, and people say, oh, the cost is 20% more to deliver care. That is not true. If that wasn't true, you would be able to take care of Medicare patients in a primary care setting in Alaska without operating at a $1 million loss after 1 year. So it is, we see it acutely at the Heart Institute because we accept all patients, and if anyone has anything remotely related to a cardiovascular disease, such as hypertension, they come to our office for management of their cardiac problem, which is hypertension, and it is a constant source of concern among my partners that as less people accept Medicare patients, our population of Medicare patients continues to grow.
Thank you. I guess this is another question for an audience member. How much cost shifting do you see in three fields, primary care, cardiology, orthopedics, in terms of cost shifting from one kind of way of paying to another? Anyone want to take a shot at that? Looks like Dr. Hall is interested.
I don't know about so much cost shifting, but like I mentioned earlier, like in our practice, 50% of the patients are Medicare, Medicaid, VA, and only 35% are private insurance. So, you know, and our group takes a lot of emergency room call, as does Dr. Watkins, and, you know, we have a lot of people that don't pay us either and still get provided service. So, like I said earlier, the private pay patient is, you know, subsidizing the care of other people, but to the extent, I'm not sure I could tell you a number.
Others among the providers here in this?
No, I think there's a lot of cost shifting in healthcare in all of these fields. You know, we charge a lot. It's supposed to cover those that can't pay. I think prices in Alaska are too high, and it shouldn't be as high as they are, but they are partially high to cover the indigent people that can't pay. But that's an issue countrywide, not just Alaska.
Right. So this is a question that goes a little bit to what Charles Wolforth talked about a little bit about. He talked about structural factors and perhaps factors within the control of the political system. I've often thought of that sometimes as structural factors and cultural factors. And one of the tricky parts is what I've found in talking to people is that everybody wants to talk about somebody else's culture. They don't want to talk about their own. But this audience member asks, do regional and national healthcare systems expect higher margins in Alaska? Why do they do so, if so, and how much higher margin is enough? Charles or Dr. Gross?
I mean, there's not that many of them. There's Alaska Regional Providence. You know, I looked at the data is old, but when we were working on that column, I looked at Providence's 990s, and their margins were certainly higher in Alaska. And there's some use of funds to guarantee debt elsewhere in the system. Although I don't know if there's actual transfer of funds elsewhere in the system. I don't think that's the main factor that's going on here, and we'd kind of have to have an executive from one of those companies to tell us in terms of the private companies.
Bruce Lamoureux, you have a thought about that?
Well, yeah, if look at Providence St. Joseph Health, the cash, the assets that are created here in Alaska remain part of Providence, Alaska, but we are part of what is termed one obligated group, and that has to do with things like credit rating agencies. So as I tell members of my governing board and employees, the good news is we have the savings to be able to invest to continue our healthcare services. The bad news is I can't use them anytime I want. It has to be in the context of the system priorities. So to the issue of our assets leaving the community created here in Alaska for Alaskans, and accruing to the benefit of others, the answer is no. But again, the bad news is the savings we do have, we don't have unilateral authority to use as we may wish.
Okay. I'm going to go with the longtime doctor's philosophical questions, their broader scope. One question he asks is, and they're related, what percentage of Alaska's GDP should be spent on health care? And Mark Foster adds, is 20% of GDP enough, something, a number that we're at or heading towards rapidly? And a related question would be, what does the best health care Alaska can afford look like? Let anybody start who would want to take shots at this. Dr. Gross.
I don't think Alaska should be spending any more on health care or any higher GDP on health care than other countries spend. And we are so much higher than virtually every other country. I think the average, or the next ones down, started around 12, 11, 10% of GDP. So that's where I think we should be, and I think we can, with a different system, still provide really good health care to everyone, not just some.
Well, I think, you know, we've reached the point where the system is breaking. We've got I've talked to a lot of people who said, well, my individual policy on the Affordable Care Act marketplace is so high that it's easier for me to pay out of pocket and pay the tax fee. You can save a lot of money by leaving Alaska for any kind of major procedure and get it somewhere else. So we're at the point where the competition is actually coming from people foregoing health care or going to other models or simply leaving. So that's sort of going to be the competitive pressure perhaps to start, you know, which maybe is already having an effect. But we're already at the point where the amount of our economic output that we're putting into healthcare is I think, significantly depressing the economic activity of the entire state. And it does it in a variety of ways. One is it means that compensation increases for employees don't go into pay, they go into benefits. And that's significant in the government and also for private employers. For government, what it means is you end up with teachers voting down their contracts because they never get a raise, right? Or they get very small raises, while the cost of employing them goes steadily up. And so what can be delivered to the classroom is the same or worse, but the cost to the government is greater. And that can obviously only go on so long. You got teachers leaving the profession because they don't see any future in it. If you're a large employer and you need to hire employees, you're competing nationwide for skilled employees. You can't offer them the same package of benefits and compensation because the healthcare component is so much larger that eats up a huge part of what you're able to give that employee. You have to give them healthcare, and so then you're constrained in what you can offer them in wages, and that means that you get less competitive people. You don't get as good of people, or you can't hire as many of them. You simply have to avoid it. And then at the part of the economy where you have small employers or startups, they're constrained to the point where they can't even function. I've talked to people who've simply left the state because they could no longer afford the health insurance premiums for their small business, and many others who are, you know, in the startup realm, which is where all the economic activity and growth is coming in our country, and who say, you know, well, you can do this if your spouse has insurance, but if you have insurance, you simply can't do it. You can't start a business. You can't run a business until you get pretty large and pretty profitable. So there's the aspect of it where 20% of your economy, economic activity is taken away and given to one sector, and that's a big part. But then there's the other aspect of all these factors that make our economy less competitive compared to places elsewhere in the country. And then I guess the final thing is, we talk about higher costs for living in Alaska, and it's kind of a mystery. You know, economists sort of say, well, shipping doesn't really cost that much anymore. A lot of things really don't cost that much anymore. Why does it cost more to live here in Alaska? Well, I think it's largely because of the cost of health care. That's built into all of our salaries, and that means it's built into all of our prices, and that means that everything we buy is more expensive, and we're less competitive in every aspect of our lives.
Well, speaking of jobs, we started with Mr. Lamoureux, the CEO of the largest private employer in the state, and we're going to end with him. Mr. Lamoureux, do you have a final thought?
Yeah, I want to build on prior comments. If we continue to engage in magical thinking that somehow the costs of care are going to diminish in the face of an aging population, an obesity epidemic, and a multitude of other ailments related to social determinants of health, nothing's going to get solved. And so if we look back in history around great societal movements, the abolition of slavery, women's right to vote, the common denominator in those and other instances has been moral outrage. It is when the middle class and others are so incensed with the circumstance that they are compelled to act on it. We are not going to get to a 12% GDP vis-a-vis healthcare doing the things we're doing now. It's insanity to think that. And instead, if we want to do that, we have to invest more in primary care. We have to own part of the solution as individual patients. And there are a multitude of things that are really unpopular. So in our most vile politicized moments, we've talked about death panels. Well, if you look at countries with low GDP, they're willing to have a conversation, a courageous conversation, related to some form of limitation. Now, you may not like limitation, you may not like the word rationing, you may not like any number of words, but if we don't have the conversation about saying that it might not be the best idea to put in a super duper titanium hip implant in a 98-year-old who thinks he's going to resurrect his Olympic career, and instead there's a less costly alternative, unless we're willing to have those conversations, we're just wishfully thinking for this to resolve. So I encourage that courageous conversation with physicians at the center, and the right investments and proper engagement of you and I as patients.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans Today on Alaska Public Media. We've been hearing from experts and physicians examining the causes for Alaska's high healthcare costs. This program was edited from the full event. If you're interested in hearing the rest of the audio, you can find that at alaskapublic.org. I'm your host and producer for Addressing Alaskans, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.